The following interviews and commentaries are for entertainment only. The views and opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
It's time again for Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio with the latest news and conversation related to firearms and your Second Amendment rights. Sponsored by Rogers Auto Repair, Arctic RV, Auto Trim Design, and Frontier Outfitters. And now, Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz, KFAR Radio. Please call in throughout the hour to join us. 458-8255, 458-TALK. What is on your mind about firearms today? It is another great day in Fairbanks. We have sunshine. It's bright, and the temperature is minus 11. And here at the KFAR broadcasting station, Melissa Burnett is expertly running the board. Thank you, Melissa. And she keeps the archives up to date for us. So if you miss a program, it will be accessible in the archives within a couple of days. Well, what's on our agenda for today? A lot. Today, I will continue my book review on Jack Hinson's One Man War, A Civil War Sniper by Tom C. McKinney, and I'll finish the introduction and move into Chapter 1, and I will also discuss the change in rules by the ATF on pistol braces and SBRs, that short-barreled rifle. So I have a lot of information to cover today. I'm going to go fast, and if we don't finish something, I will finish it next week. Announcements. Chuck Andereiden's next Alaska concealed handgun permit class is this weekend, February 11th and 12th, and then after that, March 25 and 26, and then April 22nd and 23rd. Sign up at mylegalheat.com under classes. Just type in your zip code and the class dates will come up, or visit Chuck's website at c4traininggroup.com. Sign up through the link at his website. Chuck's Red Dot Transition course is coming up quick, March 12th at TVSA, and more. After the success of his last defensive handgun for the Armed Citizen class, Chuck scheduled another one for April 15 and 16. It's on his website. Students will learn from force-on-force scenarios, including a grand finale involving all of the students. Scenarios are debriefed with discussion on what is expected and possible courses of action. The defensive shotgun class is June 10th and 11th, and Chuck's defensive rifle class is July 22nd and 23rd. And one more, the final defensive handgun level 2 class for those who have taken defensive handgun level 1 or the defensive handgun for the armed citizen class will be August 12th and 13th. You can call Chuck at 844-966-4079 for more information or go to his website, c4traininggroup.com, and you can sign up there. And Glenn Miller, who's still traveling the East Coast, Glenn Miller's monthly mass, Miller's Action Speed Shooting, MASS mass, is coming up this Saturday, February 11. Match begins at 10 a.m. and finishes around noon. Caliber is 22. Glenn added new targets, and he's got more variety and challenges to the match now. So new shooters and junior shooters under 18, shoot free. You can't beat that. Registration is at practicescore.com. To sign up, look for Miller's Action Speed Shooting, MASS, Mass, or call Glenn at 907-347-1396 if you have questions. So let's continue my book review on Jack Hinson's One Man War, A Civil War Sniper by Tom C. McKinney. Now, last week, we covered a general summary about the book, and today we will cover Chapter 1. In Chapter 1, we build the character of the land, its people, and Jack Hinson and his family. And we have a ways to go before we move into the critical action in the book. There is just a bit of important information from the book's introduction from last week that I did not have time for, so let me fill that in before I get to Chapter 1. Now, I'm quoting from the introduction, quote, "The story of Hinson and his pursuers is true, but it will seem like fiction. It is a story of a responsible family man, prosperous and prominent in his community, with vast land holdings. His plantation home was at times a hospice to travelers and to prominent people. General Grant had been a guest there. Although Henson owned a large plantation with many slaves, he opposed secession. In most ways, he was a fairly typical man of the South and of his time, but he didn't want to see the nation divided, and he opposed the war, unquote. Jack Henson really did not want to get involved with the Civil War. He wanted to remain neutral. And when the Civil War increasingly intruded into Henson's life, neutrality became increasingly difficult for him to maintain. And by the time the battle at Fort Donelson took place, with some of it actually fought on his land, Henson could no longer maintain his neutrality. And here's a quote, "And in the federal occupation that followed, one tragic act of brutality overwhelmed it, the execution and mutilation of two of his sons by the occupying Union Army made a deadly enemy of Jack Henson and plunged the area more deeply into bloody conflict," unquote. Now, Jack Henson wanted vengeance. Quote, "He set out to get vengeance, and this he did spectacularly. He had a rifle specifically made for long-range accuracy and began a one-man war against the Union he had previously supported. As a lone sniper, he became a deadly gadfly to the occupying army and to personnel aboard Navy boats on the rivers. By the end of the war, he had probably killed more than 100. He operated alone, except when making history with Nathan Bedford Forrest as a guide. Elements of 9 regiments, both cavalry and infantry, and an amphibious task force of specially built Navy boats with a special operations Marine brigade targeted the elderly man with a growing price on his head, and they never got him," unquote. Now, the author goes on to summarize the generational effect of this story. Quote, "This is the story of one man's reluctant but savage war with his country, vengeance, and the high price it exacts in not only one life or one family, but a toll that can be levied upon generations yet unborn with open-ended tragedy," unquote. Now, the book's author, McKinney, describes how he has attended reunions, talked with living sources, reviewed personal papers and family records. He climbed the same rugged hills as Jack Henson did. And McKinney walked through the same forests. He waded in the same swampland that Henson operated in. He moved through the same creeks and meadows. He was trying to understand firsthand Henson's life and how he operated. And in the end, McKinney says, quote, "He," meaning Jack Henson, "has proved as elusive to me as he was to the Union troops, who futilely pursued him and the bounties upon his head. Now, at long last, I have found him. This book is his story," unquote. So let's get started on Chapter 1. And today, in Chapter 1, we build the character of the land and its people and Jack Henson himself and his family. And as I mentioned, we have a ways to go before we get into the critical action in the book. The first chapter lays out the political groundwork of the time, as well as provides important foundation information about Jack Henson's family and his life and the type of man that he was. And I don't want to get into a long history about political background of the Civil War, so I will just hit the high points that are most important to Jack Henson's life when that's necessary. I'll also share from the book the philosophy of the people who inhabited the inland peninsula known as Between the Rivers, or as they called it in those days, Tween the Rivers. And last week, we learned that in the 1800s, Between the Rivers, where Jack Henson and his family lived at Bubbling Springs, it is a finger or a peninsula of land bordering Kentucky and Tennessee. It was located between the Cumberland River on the east and the Tennessee River on the west. And the tip of the peninsula was bordered by the Ohio River. And there were no bridges across these rivers, and the people who lived in this community during the 1800s were isolated in their daily lives. Today, that area is known as Lakes National Recreation Area, or Land Between the Lakes, and it's 170,000 acres of forests, wetlands, open lands, western Kentucky and Tennessee. And we're going to go to our first break, so stay with us for this exciting story.
We don't always get to choose the road we travel, but when we're on that road, we go forward. Through the weather, the turns, all the challenges that can slow us down. Arctic RV encourages you to keep at it. Spring is coming and the road conditions are improving. Arctic RV is closed for winter, but they reopen Monday, April 3rd. We'll see you soon. Travel, explore, camp, get out and play in Alaska, and do it in comfort. Arctic RV, rough it in style.
Hey, Interior Alaska, it's Steve at Auto Trim Design, and I've got more amazing savings to pass on to you. Our most popular CompuStar remote starts with drone mobile are all $100 off. While stock lasts, you can get a CompuStar remote start with drone mobile and start your vehicle from anywhere you have cell data service or with your new remote. What a perfect upgrade for here in Alaska. So make your appointment today at Auto Trim Design to save $100. And as Ben says,
we will be here when the other guys are gone.
Weather brought to you by Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing, offering 24-hour service from Salcha to Nanana and no mileage charge on callouts. The Bigfoot with the helping hand. Bigfoot Pumping and Thawing.
KFAR weather.
Overcast skies today with a chance for snow. Daytime highs approaching 1 above. Northerly winds around 5 miles per hour. Cloudy skies tonight, chance of snow. Lows level off around 20 below. Highs level off around 0. Tomorrow, sunshine mixed with clouds at times. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz and Melissa Burnett, KFAR Radio. Please call in 458-8255-458-TALK and let us know what's on your mind about firearms today, or you can just sit back and listen to this great story. So in modern times, the dams were built on the Cumberland River and the Tennessee River, and now that peninsula is bordered by what is called Kentucky Lake and Lake Barkley. And families with a century or more of roots were forced to leave the area when the Tennessee Valley Authority made changes and built those dams. And again, the area is called Land Between the Lakes today because the Tennessee Valley Authority dammed the river and created the lakes. But before that, the resident population called it Land Between the Rivers or Tween the Rivers, and that's the terminology we'll use in this book. Now, today, that land is a tourist recreational area. It's visited by hunters, fishermen, boaters. The only inhabitants are the USDA Forest Service personnel. The original pre-war families in this area lived on either the Kentucky side or the Tennessee side. On the Tennessee side, most of the land was encompassed by Stewart County. And I just wanted to throw that out, Stewart County, because this will be an important item in our discussion later on. The book describes the Inland Peninsula as river country. Quote, the lives of the people were woven inextricably into turns, currents, channels, and the rising and falling of the mighty streams that enclosed their land, unquote. Their land and natural waterways were their economy. The rivers and the canebrakes and the cypress swamps and the marshes allowed for an abundance of fish and waterfowl. The few manufactured goods that they needed could be brought up on the rivers. And it was also these rivers that allowed the peninsula population to ship their hides, cotton, tobacco, cross ties, barrel staves, and whiskey to the larger markets, eventually ending up in Nashville, Louisville, Memphis, and New Orleans. Now, the population was self-sufficient in providing what they needed by growing, hunting, fishing, or bartering with their neighbors, and any extra they could ship down the rivers to the larger markets. The people that McKinney describes, let me use a quote, the typical original settlers between the rivers had come from the Carolinas, where many had fought at Kings Mountain, and in other battles with Brigadier General Francis Marion, the Swamp Fox of the American Revolution. Many, if not most, of the settlers had come to the Carolinas from Scotland, some by way of Ireland, fleeing persecution. Thus, the classification applied to them by some as Scotch-Irish. By ancestral nature, these people were fiercely independent, self-reliant, clannish, and suspicious of outsiders, unquote. And we are told these people were tough and accustomed to hard hard work and hardship. Their natural environment at Tween the Rivers, between the rivers, in the vernacular, Tween the Rivers, intensified those traits. Now, the book describes them as, quote, mountaineers without mountains, or they're isolated. Isolation that makes mountaineers, it is isolation that makes mountaineers what they are, not the mountains, end quote. Now, during the early 1800s, there were often political border disputes between Kentucky and Tennessee, not to mention county seats and law enforcement issues. But the Between the Rivers people were indifferent for the most part. Quote, they had little interest in matters of law and government beyond their rivers, including those that could affect them. They were interested primarily in their own very local affairs and wanted most of all to be left alone. And incidentally, they definitely did consider them to be their rivers, end quote. And I want to read a longer paragraph setting the tone for the mindset of these people, along with that of Jack Hinson, the subject of our book. Quote, their attitudes, customs, and bits of a language of many were Scottish Highlands, like the settlers in the southern Appalachian Mountains from whence they had come. The people between the rivers had brought and retained into the second and third generations some of the customs, values, and traditions of the Scottish clans. Among these was the law of vengeance, a pivotal factor in the story, and such a man was John W. Hinson, whose story this is, unquote. So Jack Hinson's real name was John W. Hinson, but he was called Old Jack and Captain Jack Hinson from the Civil War days on, and the book normally refers to him as Jack Hinson. And now Jack Hinson seems to have settled in the Between the Rivers area during the first half of the 19th century. He married Elizabeth James, he established a farm home, and he began to raise a family. Quote, like the rest of the settlers between the rivers, all he wanted was a chance to work, conduct his business enterprises, support his family, and to be left alone, unquote. Now, Jack Hinson, as well as other descendants of the original 18th century settlers on Between the Rivers, kept their cultural proudness, their independent ways, up until they were driven away. And first, the Civil War between 1861 and 1865 caused that area to depopulate. And second, of course, in the 20th century, the damming of the rivers and the remaining population was forced to leave. And as I said, the Kentucky Dam creating the Kentucky Lake was built in 1938 and 1944, and the dam to create Lake Barkley was built in 1966. So let's talk about the economy of the area. Before the Civil War, the population between the rivers was subsistence farming, hunting, fishing, and barter helped round things out. And Jack Hinson's family farm could be completely self-sufficient, as could most of the other farms in the area, save for salt or sugar, but even they could get salt from natural salt licks or sorghum cane. They could get sugar from sorghum cane or honey. And so pretty much anything a family needed could be produced on the farm. The cash crops were cotton and tobacco. They also sold corn, but they mostly produced the corn to feed the livestock and for making cornmeal. And whiskey. Corn was used to make whiskey, which we are told is a skill the settlers brought with them from the north of Britain, and they took pride in this. Quote, most settlers made whiskey only for home use, but surplus could be sold or bartered. As commercial contact increased with the markets beyond their rivers, the people produced whiskey in increasing amounts for export and sale. By the turn of the 20th century, the land between the rivers had become an exporter of whiskey with Golden Pond. Golden Pond, the city in Trigg County, Kentucky, the industry center. The best whiskey was made between the rivers. The best of the best came from or through Golden Pond, end quote. And just Google Golden Pond whiskey if you want to learn about that. Now, families also planted cotton, but mostly for their own use, spinning, weaving, and quilting, because cotton depleted the soil. And once the soil was depleted, the farmers just planted other cash crops in its place. They grew hemp and flax for spinning yarn and weaving linen. Now, hemp was valuable because the fibers were used to make rope. Metal chain, even if it was available, was too expensive to afford. There were sawmills and grist mills operated in the area. And as that economy prospered, County politicians started to regulate and tax the people between the rivers, and soon permits were issued and prices were regulated. Quote, the people resented all such government intrusion into their life and evaded it when they could, unquote. And there is one heavy industry in the area, which was iron processing. And the author says the old abandoned smelting furnaces in states of ruin can still be seen in that area. The book goes on to detail the ore processing in the area between 1815 and 1860. That's 1 year before the Civil War started. The area is rich in high-quality ore, brown hematite and limonite, as well as limestone, which they used for a flux. And with the navigable rivers on three sides of the peninsula, it was easy to ship product to the larger population centers. So the iron was a cash product for that area. And also in abundance were hardwood trees. Charcoal was another export of the peninsula people. Now about the iron smelting industry, the author writes, quote, in addition to all this, adjacent rich farmland provided ample food for the hardworking crews, many of which were made up of immigrants brought in for that purpose or locally owned slaves. The iron industry, with its furnaces, mills, and cleared coaling fields, would play a significant role in the coming war and in the Henson family's role in it, unquote. And the families between the rivers were isolated, as I said, and by choice, few of them traveled out of the peninsula's boundaries. The original inhabitants arrived in the late 1700s to settle on land grants. These land grants were awarded for service in the Revolutionary War. The thing is, while the rest of the region continued to modernize and change, the between the rivers people did not change much at all. A century after the original inhabitants settled in, life was pretty much the same, and the author says this was not altogether a bad thing. So now we know about the people in general and the economy of the area, let's take a look at Jack Henson's family. Jack was born John W. Henson in North Carolina in July of 1807, and he moved to Tennessee with his family in 1830. Henson was said not to be a tall man. Quote, he was about 5 feet, 5 inches tall, lean and strong, and with unusually long and muscular arms. One local lady, who lived to be 102, vividly remembered descriptions of his long, muscular arms. When asked what he looked like, she replied, he looked like Popeye, unquote. Now, I am going to quote from the book more about Jack Henson's description because it will help us visualize him later on as a sniper in the wilds, and it will help us understand his personality and his thinking better. Quote, he was serious and strong-willed. His posture was erect and his gaze steady. His manners were courtly and genteel for that raw frontier, and his strength of character was apparent. He was a quiet man who spoke sparingly, yet in his manner and countenance there was a suggestion that his relatively small side concealed a combination of great strength and good courage, if not outright menace. Confederate Major Charles W. Anderson, wartime adjutant general to General Nathan Bedford Forrest, knew Jack Henson and served with him on at least three occasions during the war. He has given us the only known surviving complete physical description of Jack Henson. Major Anderson described Henson's clear gray eyes, compressed lips, massive jaws, and offered his opinion that Henson's natural appearance clearly indicated that under no circumstance was he a man to be trifled with or aroused. His eyes were narrow, high above the cheekbones, almost suggesting the Oriental, but inclining slightly upward towards the center of his forehead. Known in the family as Henson eyes, they're a strong genetic characteristic which continues to appear in his descendants today, unquote. And I want to read one more paragraph that will help us define Jack Henson. I think I can do this before the break. Quote, within this quiet, courteous man, there lay a depth of character and great inner strength like a coiled spring of tempered steel, ready at all times for instantaneous action. In a metaphor often used in the rural South to describe such a man, he was small but wound up tight, never boastful nor even conspicuous, but demonstrably without fear. He was, as Major Anderson put it, indeed a man not to be trifled with or aroused. The same thing, incidentally, could be said of his sons, grandsons, and great grandsons. These traits seem to have a strong hereditary dominance and carried with them the potential for tragedy, unquote. And how are we doing?
Yeah, it's time.
It's break time. Okay, take a break, folks, and come back for the second half of this story and the NFA rules.
Makes great times even better. Sponsoring the KFAR live stream at
Fox News, I'm Rich Dennison. New information is revealed about the suspected Chinese spy balloon as Congress gets a briefing.
That balloon, part of a massive Chinese espionage program. It's run by the People's Liberation Army. It's designed to gather intelligence on military capabilities. Now, these aircrafts, they've been spotted in at least five continents and regions around the world.
Fox's Aisha Hosni on Capitol Hill. At least three Americans are among the more than 20,000 dead from the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria.
The U.S. has also sent aid to the region, including search and rescue teams. The total number to have been killed in Turkey and Syria now surpasses the 18,400 who died in the earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan in 2011.
Fox's Jonathan Savage. The number of Americans filing for new unemployment claims rose slightly last week, but layoffs remain at historic lows. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
In the wake of the pandemic, scammers have evolved with the times to spuriously enter the world of online dating, student loan relief, pandemic assistance, and technical support, all in an attempt to defraud unassuming victims. Checking email or answering the phone can put many Americans at risk of cyber attacks. It is a nationwide problem that has only been exacerbated since the onset of the pandemic. According to the FBI's Internet Crime Report, there have been just under 3 million complaints of fraud in the past 5 years. Those complaints have resulted in $18.7 billion in losses. The Federal Trade Commission recently released data on which states have experienced the most imposter scams. Maryland leads the country as the most scammed state with 639.7 reports per million people. The other states with the most imposter scams are Alaska with 628.2 per million and Delaware with 584.9 per million. The FBI says to look out for grammatical mistakes, false processing fees, and unverified email addresses or websites.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
When you know the person who works on your car or truck, that's worth something. It gives a level of confidence that's hard to come by. That's Rogers Auto Repair. Family owned and operated, Rogers is your complete automotive repair shop. Tune-ups, winterizing, even engine and transmission rebuilds are all done right in their shop on Dale Road near the airport. So call the folks with experience and a sound reputation. Call Rogers Auto Repair. You'll be their next satisfied customer. Call 479-6665. Rogers Auto Repair.
Explore winter trails you never thought possible. Stand, float, walk on snow with better traction and stability than walking down the street. Modern snowshoes are the perfection of a thousand-year-old idea. They're lightweight and versatile, easy and fun to use for all ages. If you can walk, you can snowshoe. Get the exercise you crave. Let it snow. Go explore. Start today. No lift ticket required. But first, find the right style and the right fit at Frontier Outfitters. Frontier Outfitters, for your Alaskan lifestyle.
Hey, Interior Alaska, it's Steve at Auto Trim Design, and I've got more amazing savings to pass on to you. Our most popular CompuStar remote starts with drone mobile are all $100 off. While stock lasts, you can get a CompuStar remote start with drone mobile and start your vehicle from anywhere you have cell data service or with your new remote. What a perfect upgrade for here in Alaska. So make your appointment today at Auto Trim Design to save $100. And as Ben says,
we will be here when the other guys are gone.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz and Melissa Burnett, KFAR Radio. Please call in at 458-8255, 458-TALK, and let us know what's on your mind about firearms today. All right, let me pick up from before the break. I'm going to run through a timeline of Jack Kinson's life from the point he got married up until 1860, the year before the Civil War. Now, Jack's wife, Elizabeth James Henson, was born in 1817. Jack was born in 1807. So Jack would have been about 10 years older than his wife. Jack and Elizabeth married about 1835, but the author could not find any records of the exact date of their marriage. Quote, Jack Kinson today would be called an achiever. He was serious, goal-oriented, a hard worker, a man of means. He was not only a prosperous farmer, but also bought and sold farmland, timberland, and other properties in the area, sometimes alone and sometimes in partnership with others, unquote. Hinson did not just own rural properties. He also owned building lots in Dover, Tennessee. His business dealings were not only in Stewart County, Tennessee, but he bought and sold land and other items across the Tennessee River in Henry County. And from my reading, it sounds like he was not only a successful large farm owner, but an enterprising businessman too. And I said that Jack and his wife were married around 1835. By the time of the 1840 census, it was recorded that Jack owned 10 slaves, which I read was typical of a substantial landowner in that area. And for comparison, the larger plantations in those states might own 100 or more slaves. By the 1840s census, Jack was 33 years old. Elizabeth was 23 years old. Their firstborn son, Robert A., was 3 years old, and their baby, George, was one. And moving on, by 1847, Hinson increased his land ownership when he acquired 400 acres on the upper waters of Lick Creek by means of a Tennessee land grant. And this is the start of Hinson's permanent home, and they named their home Bubbling Springs. Over time, that 400-acre farm became a 1,200-acre farm, and Jack had a growing number of slaves working there. 3 years later, October 1850, Jack's and Elizabeth's home and farm were well established, and they had four more children, William 8, John 6, Albert 4, and Joseph 2. Now, Elizabeth had by now given birth to at least six sons in 15 years, and the author points out that there's no way to know how many other children might have been born or died between census-taking periods because there's no records. The family Bible, the letters, the photographs, and any other records had been destroyed when the Union soldiers burned the Bubbling Springs house to the ground. And moving on, 3 years later, it's now 1853, and Jack Kinson is issued a tavern keeper's license. And at that time in history, in that area, if you had a home large enough to have extra bedrooms and the ability to serve meals, you could host overnight guests. But there were rules, and these large homes had to be located on or near existing stagecoach routes. There weren't many inns at that time, so by allowing private parties to use their homes for overnight travelers, this helped the area as a whole. And interesting to me was, quote, by the unwritten protocols of the rural South, all farm families were expected to take in individual travelers overnight and feed them, but not in the numbers of stagecoach loads of passengers, unquote. Jack also built a toll road in Stewart County, and that road passed through his land, and he stationed trusted slaves at each end to collect the toll, and I think that was common back then from my reading. And now we move ahead to 1860, 1 year before the Civil War, quote, John and Elizabeth, still at Bubbling Springs, had eight of their 10 children at home. The two oldest sons, Robert 25 and George 20, had moved out to make homes of their own. The Hinson sons at home in 1860 were William, now 18, John 15, Albert 14, Joseph 12, Charles 10, and Thomas W. 8. And after having born at least eight sons, Elizabeth had been blessed with two little girls, Mary 3 and Sarah Margaret 2, unquote. So, by recapping, By 1860, 1 year before the Civil War, Hinson's two oldest sons were off on their own, but the Hinsons had six younger sons living at home, plus two daughters. Also living with them was Amanda Nelson, 24 years old, and it's thought she was a live-in teacher for the children. A live-in teacher was how families on prosperous farms provided formal education for their children. And Jack Hinson's home was characteristic of the homes of prosperous men at that time and in that location. Lots of rooms for a large family and extra house guests and stagecoach travelers. Quote, a large separate back kitchen spared the rest of the house the heat of cooking in summer and in winter. It was a pleasant, warm, good-smelling place to sit. The kitchen was presided over by a slave named Sarah, who also supervised the other house servants. In peculiar protocol of the Old South, a matter largely incomprehensible in the North, Sarah, although a slave, enjoyed in many ways the status of an elder member of the family and mentor of the children, unquote. As was the custom, Sarah addressed the children of the house with respect, as in like Miss Mary, but Sarah's words also carried unquestioned authority. Quote, the children dared not treat her with disrespect or misbehave in her presence, and in that kitchen, she was virtually sovereign, unquote. Now, the house was named Bubbling Springs because the free-flowing springs ran behind the great house. That provided the family with fresh, cold drinking water, and a spring also flowed through the spring house where cool water kept milk, cream, butter, and other perishables cool and kept them from spoiling. The springs provided water for stock, for swimming, for fishing, and I mentioned earlier about the cotton, flax, and hemp. Hinson's farm had sheep for wool and meat. They kept chickens, guinea fowl, geese, ducks, and turkeys for eggs and food and mattress and pillow down. Hogs were the main source of meat, and there was a kitchen garden to provide vegetables, not only for the family, but for the hired hands and slaves. Their orchards had apples, peaches, pears, plums, crabapples, and muscadines. They had grapevines on overhead arbors for fruit, preserves, and wine. Their beehives provided honey and pollination for the fruit tree blossoms. They grew corn and wheat and had it ground at the grist mills to make milk, cornmeal, and flour. And one more thing, quote, unlike at smaller farms in the county, whiskey was not made at Bubbling Springs. The Hinsons could afford to buy it, unquote. So the author further tells us that Bubbling Springs was a self-contained little community. Quote, there were barns for livestock and hay and for curing tobacco, a smokehouse for preserving and storing hams, bacon, and other meat, stables, a woodshed, and other outbuildings. A root cellar kept such root foods as potatoes, sweet potatoes, and turnips. It also stored keeper apples and varieties and large, hard kefir pears, which softened during the cool fall weather. In its blacksmith shop, horseshoes, mule shoes, hinges, and other hardware were made. Tools were repaired. The blacksmith with either a skilled farmhand or a slave trained to do the work, unquote. The slaves lived in cabins built about 300 feet from the great house. The slaves kept some of their own chickens, and they could have their own garden plots. In the area, the Hinsons were a prominent and well-respected family. Quote, not merely prosperous, they were also genteel, educated people by the standards of that rough-hewn time and place. They were examples of what Thomas Jefferson called the natural aristocracy, those who, regardless of ancestry, were gracious, responsible, productive, and given to learning and self-improvement, unquote. The author tells us that someone who knew the Hinson family well said, quote, the Hinsons were different. They weren't as if they weren't from here, unquote. And that same person also said, quote, the Hinson men treated ladies with deference, stood in their presence, assisted them being seated, offered an arm when appropriate, and habitually offered refreshments to all visitors. Such attitudes and customs were a natural part of the family heritage, unquote. And I'm going to stop here. I think we've built a good mental picture of the Between the Rivers land, its inhabitants, and Jack Hinson's family. We know he was prosperous, well-respected, and as the way with the people between the rivers, he wanted to live his life and be left alone. And next week, we'll start talking about changes in this peaceful pre-Civil War life. I will leave you with a quote, the tranquil, relatively isolated life of the Hinsons and of their neighbors between the rivers would soon end in a tragic, bloody conflict, one they did not want. and it would cost Jack and Elizabeth Henson their home, the death of at least seven of their children, and their freedom to live out their twilight years in peace. The peaceful isolation there between the rivers would end, shattering and crushed under the tread of massive outside forces, and still worse, neighbor would be killing neighbor, unquote. And I've got 15 minutes. Should we go to break now? And then I'll start on the ATF issue. All right, stay with us.
Out in Arizona where the bad men are, the only thing to guide you is an evening star. The roughest, toughest man by far was Ragtime Cowboy Joe. He got his name from singing to the cows and sheep. Every night they say he sings a herd to sleep.
In a bass voice rich and deep, crooning soft and low.
He always sings raggedy music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in his saddle on a horse that is syncopated, gated. There is such a funny meter to the roar of his repeater, how they run when they hear the fellas come.
We don't always get to choose the road we travel, but when we're on that road, we go forward. Through the weather, the turns, all the challenges that can slow us down, Arctic RV encourages you to keep at it. Spring is coming and the road conditions are improving. Arctic RV is closed for winter, but they reopen Monday, April 3rd. We'll see you soon. Travel, explore, camp, get out and play in Alaska, and do it in comfort. Arctic RV, rough it in style. Ice fishing is great winter fun, if you're prepared. Now, before you make your fishing hole in the ice, make Frontier Outfitters your first stop for everything you need to limit out. Rods to tackle, to ice tents, and ice augers. And Frontier Outfitters has the right winter clothing to keep you toasty, warm, and dry. Not to mention your license, guns, ammo, and a wide variety of snowshoes. Your next outdoor adventure is waiting for you. It begins at Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
Hey, Interior Alaska, it's Steve at Auto Trim Design, and I've got more amazing savings to pass on to you. Our most popular CompuStar remote starts with Drone Mobile are all $100 off. While stock lasts, you can get a CompuStar remote start with Drone Mobile and start your vehicle from anywhere you have cell data service or with your new remote. What a perfect upgrade for here in Alaska. So make your appointment today at Auto Trim Design to save $100. And as Ben says,
we will be here when the other guys are gone.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Maintaining your correct tire pressure improves safety, fuel economy, and tire life. Drop by the Tire Guys for free tire inflation. GCR Tires and Service, taming the Alaskan road. Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR weather.
Cloudy today with a chance for snow. Highs around 1 above. Winds out of the north, around 5 miles per hour. Overcast skies. Tonight, chance of snow. Lows around 20 below. Sunshine mixed with clouds at times. Tomorrow, daytime highs approaching 0. Near 10 above. Saturday, near 0. Sunday, with a chance for snow. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, back to Shooter's Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM and 660 AM. Streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Shooter's Corner with Laura Berkowitz and Melissa Burnett, KFAR Radio. Please call in at 458-8255-458-TALK and let us know what's on your mind about firearms today. Now, one of our listeners called in last week and asked if the BATFE, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, had changed the rules on pistol braces. Yes, they have changed some things. First, we may have people listening who do not know what a pistol brace is. A pistol brace, also known as a stabilizing brace, is an accessory that attaches to the rear of the gun and allows the firearm to be fired one-handed. And a pistol brace can extend back to your shoulder so that you can hold the grip of the gun and have it supported on your shoulder, or it can be an attachment to the gun that wraps around your arm. You would hold the grip of the gun with one hand, but it would be stabilized with the band extended from the rear that wraps around your forearm, usually a Velcro band. Now, pistol braces or stabilizing braces are used with the AR type of firearms. And it's my understanding that these were initially, I think in 2012, made by a company to help wounded warriors maintain safety and accuracy while shooting. And at that time, the BATFE ruled that they were legal. But from my reading, there have been a total of 4 administrative letters on the legality of pistol braces or stabilizing braces since then. The new ruling is about 300 pages. I took a look at it. I'm not going to read the whole thing. However, I have chosen a few articles from sources I commonly use to break down the information we need at this point. I'm taking much information from the article at pewpewtactical.com titled Pistol Braces and the ATF, What You Need to Know by Jack Billings, Editor-in-Chief, updated February 1st, 2023. And I suggest you look at that article. It's very good. The article has a great breakdown of the points we need to know, and it's better organized than a lot of the other articles I read. One is facts, explaining the final ruling on the stabilizing braces 2022. Number 2 is lawsuits inbound. Number 3 is what is a pistol brace. Number 4 is understanding AR pistols or SBRs. Those are short-barreled rifles. That's what's causing all the problems. ATF stance through the years. And number 6 is final thoughts. Now, again, the article is from pewpewtactical.com titled Pistol Braces and the ATF, What You Need to Know by Jack Billings, Editor-in-Chief, updated February 1st, 2023, and there's a lot of articles out there right now. I mentioned last week one of the reasons I do not normally like to get into subject like this is the legality of it all. I do not want to interpret the legality, and I do not want to be presumed to sway you one way or the other on these types of subjects. And that is a big reason why I will be using and quoting information from this article and other articles. In that regard, the article I just told you about starts out, quote, disclaimer, we are not lawyers and this is not legal advice. Always consult an attorney when it comes to firearms regulations and local state laws, unquote. Now, under the FAQ, frequently asked questions, explaining the final ruling on stabilizing braces 2023, it was on January 13th, 2023, that the ATF officially declared its stance on braces. It published new criteria with regard to stabilizing braces. Quote, Final Rule 2023R-08F clarified that a rifle is a firearm with a barrel measuring 16 inches or more that is designated to be fired from the shoulder that includes any accessory component or rearward attachment that provides surface area that allows the weapon to be fired by the shoulder, provided other factors as listed in the definition indicate the weapon is designed and intended to be fired from the shoulder, unquote. That's clear as day, right? And you can link directly to the ATF website to read the explanation. Quote, if the rifle's barrel is under 16 inches and it wears a brace, it's an SBR, a short-barreled rifle under the new guidelines. From the ATF website, quote, the rule outlines the factors ATF would consider when evaluating firearms equipped with a purported stabilizing brace or other rearward attachment to determine whether these weapons would be considered a rifle or a short-barreled rifle under the Gun Control Act of 1968, or rifle or firearm subject to the regulation under the National Firearms Act, that's the NFA. The rule's amended definition of rifle clarifies that the term designed, redesigned, made, or remade, and intended to be fired from the shoulder includes a weapon that is equipped with an accessory, component, or other rearward attachment, such as a stabilizing brace, that provides surface area that allows the weapon to be fitted from the shoulder, provided other factors as listed in the definition indicate the weapon is designed and intended to be fired from the shoulder. This rule does not affect stabilizing braces that are objectively designed and intended as a stabilizing brace for use by individuals with disability and not for shouldering the weapon as a rifle. Such stabilizing braces are designed to conform to the arm and not as a buttstock. However, if the firearm with the stabilizing brace is a short-barreled rifle, it needs to be registered no later than May 31st, 2023. This rule is effective on January 31st, was effective on January 1st, 2023, the date it was published in the Federal Register. Any weapons with the stabilizing braces or similar attachments that constitute rifles under the NFA must be registered no later than May 31st, 2023, or the short barrel removed and a 16-inch or longer barrel attached to the firearm or permanently removed and disposed of, or alter the stabilizing brace such that it cannot be reattached, or the firearm is turned into your local ATF office, or the firearm is destroyed, unquote. And I know you all understood that perfectly clearly, and that's why you're going to have to do some Googling and read some articles or the original ATF language. Now, the ATF website is organized with a section about what do you need to know so you can identify your firearms classification, and also a section on related resources. You can look at this after you've read the 300-page document, Final Rule for Stabilizing Braces. If your firearm falls into the category for which you must register, the new rules, you have 120 days to register. That's May 31st. 120 days ends May 31st. Pew Pew Tactical notes that there is a lot of confusion about the rule and what it might mean for owners of these guns, and their aim is to demystify this. And I'm quoting from the article's Q&A. Do I have to register my brace firearm as an SBR under the new rule? The answer is it depends. If it's got a barrel over 16 inches, now this is important, if it's got a barrel over 16 inches and the overall length of the firearm is at least 26 inches, it does not fall under the NFA and therefore does not have to be registered. But if you have a braced AR pistol with a barrel under 16 inches and an overall length less than 26 inches, it now qualifies as an SBR, a short-barreled rifle. And now you have options. You have a few options at that point, and your options are permanently remove or alter the brace so it can't be reattached, add a barrel longer than 16 inches, use an E-Form 1 or a paper Form 1 to register it as an SBR, turn it into your local ATF office and destroy or destroy the firearm. And the article notes that the ATF clarified that it does not regulate accessories. Braces can still be sold separately as accessories. However, braces cannot be sold on a firearm with a barrel under 16 inches without the proper NFA paperwork and transfer process. Question, if I register, how long do I have and do I have to pay the $200 tax and does the gun need to be marked? The article's answer is, quote, the final rule was published January 31st, 2023, so owners have 120 days. We talked about that, May 31st, 2023. The ATF is waiving the $200 tax for pistols and rifles with braces for applications received between January 31st and May 31st. So if you register after May 31st, you will be subjected to that $200 tax. If you register now, you won't before May 31st. There is no limit on the number of firearms you can register. Also, if you own a lower receiver with a factory installed brace, you will have to pay the $200 as the exemption is only applicable to already completed firearms. Traditionally, if you make an SBR, you must mark it, but the ATF says that no additional marking is required so long as the gun is already stamped with the manufacturer's information, unquote. As to processing time, quote, the ATF said it's adding additional internal resources to handle the influx of e-forms and that forms that fall under the final rule will be processed separately from suppressors and other e-forms, unquote. Another question, I just ordered my braced firearm and it's in transit. What do I do? The answer, FFLs expecting a braced firearm have been advised to refuse the package or call their local ATF agent and turn the package in. Consumers will not be able to take possession of braced firearms as of January 31st, 2023. The ATF has advised that FFLs can remove the brace and transfer the firearm without those. Alternatively, the customer can file the E-Form 1 or the paper Form 1 in order to get the braced firearm, unquote. And the next question is, I'm disabled. Can I own a braced firearm without registering? And the answer is, quote, short answer is no. The ATF says there are no exceptions for disabilities in the NFA, so disabled shooters will have to bring the firearm into compliance just like everyone else, unquote. The next question, I live in a state that has an SBR brand, short-barreled rifle ban, SBR ban, what now? The answer is, quote, the ATF refuses to comment on state laws and suggests you speak to an attorney general in your state for the next steps. That said, if you submit any Form 1 in a state with an SBR ban, the application will be denied by the ATF, unquote. And where are we in our timeline?
We got 10 seconds.
Okay, folks, we can talk about this again next week, but I really, really suggest after spending 2 days reading, almost 3 days reading on this, you need to read it for yourself. There's probably no one that you're going to trust except yourself to make your decision. And we will talk to you all next week.